everybody, and welcome to today's audio conference training on crafting visitation center policies that account for battering, offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International and the National Council on Juvenile and Family Court Judges. My name is Beth McNamara. I'm going to be your host for today's call. I'm going to go over our housekeeping details. We have quite a few people who are brand new to the audio conference training series that registered since we did part one, so I apologize if they seem repetitive for the folks who joined us last week, but I did want to let people know that we're getting lots of requests for people to be able to hear the recording of last week or if they're going to miss next week, and so I wanted to let people know that we are recording these three sessions, and our hope is that we'll be able to put them on our website, which means that you can do online streaming, which just means you can listen to it anytime you want off of your computer. And that will be on our website. So our hope is that we'll do the whole three-part series once it's completed. So start looking for it. Our website is www.praxisinternational.org, and you'll be able to find it there. We emailed out materials for today's session to those who registered. If you need copies sent to you during the call today, please email me at beth@praxisinternational.org, and I'll try to get those to you as quickly as possible. And any other materials and resources, we will continue to post on our website. We wanted to let you know, an important disclaimer, that the points of view on this call are of the speakers and Praxis and the National Council, and they don't necessarily represent the opinions and viewpoints of OVW. We try very hard to stay in line with OVW and the other TA providers, but we're not speaking for them, so we wanted to make sure that you knew that. Today is the second session of a three-part series on crafting visitation center policies. Today's topic is the architecture of a good policy. And so to let you know, we had an overwhelming number of people register for the call. So in order to enhance voice quality, I had a couple of questions about how to make people's line louder. So there's two suggestions that we can give you. You can hit *4 on your touch pad, and sometimes that will help increase the volume for you to be able to hear better. Sometimes it's the phone that you're using or the speakerphone capability, so sometimes if you hang up and redial in, that also helps just in a new connection. And you can also hit the operator, and Stephanie would be able to help you as well with some other suggestions. One of the other things we try to do to make sure that everybody can hear well is that we mute all of the lines throughout the call. So only the moderators and our guests are on the open line, but we also want to encourage questions and comments throughout the call. So we will open it up for questions in about 40 minutes, but you don't have to wait until we actually say now we have time for questions. You can push the number one anytime so that you're ready and in the question queue so there isn't much of a delay, or you don't get closed out and didn't hit one in that little window. So we'd love to hear from you. You can also email me during the call, and I can ask your question for you or insert it where I can. So again, Beth, beth@praxisinternational.org, and I can get that question for you. So without further ado, we have the privilege and the honor of three amazing women that we had on last week. We again have Ellen Pence, Mo Sheeran, and Jane Sadusky on our call today. Ellen's the Executive Director of Praxis. Mo's the Director of the Family Violence Department at the National Council. And Jane is a consultant with Praxis for a great number of years and has been involved for a very long time in the Supervised Visitation Program. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Ellen, and she's going to give us a little brief overview and introduction.
Thank you very much, Beth. And also, Beth, thanks for kind of getting this whole thing together. Beth has to get all three of us together. She has to send out not only everything to you guys, but she has to send it all out to us to make sure that we're all talking about the same thing. And last week, for those of you who are on the call, we went over these 9 tips of doing visitation center policies. And in doing those 9 tips, we spent almost about 90% of the time on the first 3 tips and then went very quickly through the last 6 tips. And most of the evaluations mentioned this in not such a favorable way, that we should pace ourselves better. So now we've met, and we've planned to pace ourselves much better on this call. And again, we're, you know, for those of you who didn't hear those 9 tips last time, you'll be able to go onto our website and hear those. And I think it's important for us to just say that what we were talking about in last week was trying to think about policy in terms of what is your mission, what is the whole problem we're trying to address. We're trying to do some big picture stuff. What does it mean to be client-centered in policy making instead of just, you know, making the policies fit what we need? What does it mean to make it fit what clients need? We talked a lot about the diverse needs of people, that very different people come into centers, and what does it mean to match up our policies with their diverse needs? What does it mean to get ownership and buy-in to our policies of our board, of our staff people, and even of the people using our centers and our collaborating agencies? We talked about anticipating and addressing harmful and unintended consequences in this process, and to make the assumptions and to make visible and transparent in our policy making why it is that we're doing this. What are we assuming by doing this? And so people understand when they read our policies what the thinking is behind it. And then a very big thing is keeping the difference, and you'll hear this today, the difference between this is a policy and this is a method of carrying out that policy. So policies are big directives by board of directors and policymakers to people carrying out things, and then the administrators say, now this is how you carry out what the board wanted us to do. So this distinction between policy making and procedure making. And finally, we talked about implementing, building in accountability and evaluation plans and implementing policy. So that's what we covered last week. And now this week we sent out some sample policies. We sent out 3 policies, actually 2 samples on 3 topics. One is on the use of alcohol and drugs in centers, and usually people have a policy on that, and it's usually quite short, and so we sent 2 very short samples of that. We sent, most centers have a policy on when children refuse to visit, they won't come, or they come and they don't want to visit. We sent out 2 samples on that one. And then everyone has policies regarding safety procedures, et cetera, and so we sent out 3 samples of safety-related policies, not the whole policy on safety, but some aspect of it. The purpose of this is so that we can, if you notice, if I'm hoping you all have this, because we'll be making points, abstract points, and then pointing to these policies in a way. And so if you see, there's 3 pages to this, and all of the lines on these 3 pages are numbered. So, Mo, if you want to make a point about this policy, go to the line 21 through 26, or lines 56 through 61, rather than say on page 2, sample 2, paragraph 2. So these line numbers are to get all of us to be able to refer quite quickly to this handout. So we're going to use these, and we wanted to say that we drew these policies out because they're very typical of policies in centers. We're not drawing them out because we're saying, oh, here, this is what your policy should look like. In fact, all 3 of us would have some criticism of some aspects of these policies that we're going to be looking at. But they're good examples of typical policies. And then I want to say something so you don't get too frustrated in this process. We are giving you the ideal. Ideally, policy should do all this. It's very hard to match this ideal, and no one knows better than Jane and I, who are on the phone today, who are trying to write policies for the St. Paul Criminal Justice System. And we're going around and around and around. Is this a procedure or is this a policy? And so we're on here as these big experts telling you, and then we're going through this in, you know, we're on the phone every day to each other saying, no, this can't be right. We've got to write it like this. So we're very aware of the task that we're putting before you, and we've got these rules that we're giving you of how to do it well. But applying those rules to the practicality of getting these policies out is quite difficult. So remember that this is the ideal. We're all heading that way. If you put in a procedure when it's really a policy, it's not a big panic problem. But if you were able to follow some of these guiding principles that we're giving you about doing policymaking, it would produce a very nice set of policies in the end. So let's go from there and just say that we're going to start out now. Today we're going to be talking about what we're calling the architecture of a good policy. So in other words, we're going to take some of these principles we talked about last time and these tips, and now we're going to actually say, okay, now you're ready to write a policy, and that written policy should kind of follow a certain format. And then we're going to look at some of these sample ones We'll give you some rules about writing policy. We'll look at some of the samples, and then we'll talk a little bit about how that might be improved a bit. So Jane is going to start out by just talking a little bit about this whole notion of the architecture of a good policy. We've got a worksheet for you to use when you're thinking about writing policies. And this worksheet comes right from the work that Jane and I are doing on all these criminal justice policies. So we're not asking you to do something that we haven't aren't doing every day in our own work. So take it away, Jane.
Okay. And hopefully I won't disappear into the atmospheric void of missed connections, but Beth will speak up if I do. I want to echo what Ellen said. This is a really humbling experience to be working on the St. Paul project and trying to develop all these policies. And when I look back on all of the different nonprofits and different places I was involved in writing policy, I go, "Why, gee, I wish I would have known some of this, and it might have helped us out quite a bit." One of the things you have in your handouts and your material is this design, the architecture of a good policy. And as we know, sometimes architects don't quite get it right either. I was thinking of this the other day when I was standing drying my hands in a restroom, and the towel thing or the hand dryer was right behind the door. So every time somebody came in the door, you kind of got whacked in the head while you're trying to dry your hands. And you can blame that on the architects. But we are trying to set out a structure here that will help us all kind of figure out how do we put together policies that articulate our mission, articulate our purpose, lay out what is expected of our organization in relation to the people we serve, and to do that in a way that's as clear and concise as possible. So the framework that we've come up with and that we're working off of, a couple of things that it's important to keep in mind. This isn't exactly a sequential kind of set of steps that you see in the architecture of a good policy. In many respects, we're trying to kind of keep a lot of this in mind all at the same time while we're putting things together. And what we've got laid out here really represents the work of creating the policy. So it's not necessarily that each one of these individual topic headings and what's beneath them would go into every single policy, but you have to be thinking about it. So we're always going to be thinking about things like definitions and time frames and how this fits the people that we're working with and aspects of accountability and standards. And depending on the exact policy, we might have a lot of that articulated, or it's going to be kind of in the background behind our thinking about the policy. So again, kind of keeping in mind as this notice at the top of our worksheet, it's a guide for thinking about policy development. So it's not a literal listing of sections, and it represents this work of creating the policy. So the first thing we have up there, and as I was working with this today, I was thinking, well, in some ways this kind of comes a lot later when you actually sit down and write the statement and say, this is the policy. But the first framework is opening with a statement of the policy that's clear, precise. It lays out the scope. Sometimes you might have a link to some documentation or references. For example, if you're writing a policy area that's required by state law, then there's going to be a piece of that that most likely is going to reference pretty early on what that law would be. So in Wisconsin, for example, which is a mandatory arrest state, in related to domestic violence crimes, any police department policy you read about their domestic violence response will kind of immediately reference that statutory language. So sometimes you're going to have that, sometimes you won't. If you look at our sample policies, I think we've got a couple of examples where the policy writers did a pretty good job of being clear and precise, and a couple where that kind of wandered away. So, for example, on page one, samples one and two, both of those are pretty direct about this is the policy. Line two, alcohol and drugs are not permitted. Any client, staff, or volunteers under the influence may be asked to leave, so forth. And similarly with that second one, if you take a look at the last policy example and go to line 63, here things get a little murky. There's a statement of purpose, and then it slides over into practice. But it's not a very clear and concise statement of the policy is. Our agency will. This will happen. But it kind of gets confused a bit around this broader statement of purpose and then kind of slides into more of that procedure end of things. So that first point that we've got laid out here is when you get to the point of writing the policy, you want to aim for being clear, being precise, and laying out the scope under which this is going to apply. So, for example, in that first one, it's clear that this applies to anyone who's coming through the doors of the center. And in the second one, there's this kind of more general no one. It's not quite so clear there who the audience there is. Is the no one including all of the staff, the volunteers, the parents who are coming into the center, or is this being written more specifically with parents in mind? So a little additional clarification might be in order there. And with that, I'm going to slide us on over to Mo, who's going to pick up on the second element.
Thank you, Jane. And some of what I'm going to be talking about sort of really goes is linked directly with what Jane's talking about and then takes it a little bit further. And I also want to sort of state that I have been involved in a lot of different policy writing and experience the same humility that these women have been talking about. And one thing that I'll do when I'm looking at the kinds of policies that we're trying to write, maybe it's for personnel or whatever, is to actually sort of look at it and see if it is clear why it is that we're doing that. So often we'll see a rule but have no idea why it's there. So that just states the importance of actually articulating the policies and intent of the goals. One of the places, and I want to just sort of tie back into what Jane was talking about, and I want to grab on to line number 7, where it says that we believe that being under the influence of drugs and alcohol causes everyone's safety to be at risk. That really does sort of outline to you what the board actually believes is the truth, or the policymaker believes is the truth, and why the policy is being written. I also want to pull out another example of when that same articulation exists, and that would be on line number 30, where it says to ensure that visitation takes place in a happy and healthy manner. And it pretty much states what it is, the goal of this policy. It is also important that the policies that we do actually link back to the organization's mission and role. And in this case, I don't really have some of the organization's mission and role, but what I do have are the guiding principles. And as we've said in the guiding principles, that we covered last week, and I believe that you all received them and they were handed out. And that is that the first one is that safe havens, visitation centers should operate in such a way that it accounts for the safety of both child and the adult victim, and that safety is treated with equal regard. As we look at other of the policies, and right now I actually specifically want to look at line number 43, which is actually talking about how the center supports safety for children, parents, and staff. And then it goes on to talk about some of the values that underlie that. We encourage mutual respect and healthy interactions. I think those are really good examples of ways in which, if you look at the policy, you can see what it is the policy is trying to do. Another thing that's really important in articulating the policy's intents and goals is to be able to state the exceptions when this policy should not apply. And now I want to look at another one of the sample policies that we've received so that we can talk about how the importance of tailoring this policy to account for when exceptions apply. On item number, line 69, 70, and 71.
Boy, you're doing very good at directing us to where you want us to be.
Thanks, Al.
Yeah, very good. I'm very impressed.
Thank you, because I think you're going to enjoy this next one.
Okay.
Now, when we're talking about the safety for all involved, this particular policy, which we want to talk about procedures, and Jane, I think we're going to be delineating between policies and procedures later on, or should I do some of that now?
Later on.
Okay, cool.
Right, later on.
Okay, so when you look at 69, 70, and 71, it talks about the non-custodial parent arriving at his or her designated time for the visitation first, then enters the building. The monitor or designee signs them in the logbook. This particular procedure, actually, but policy also, doesn't really articulate the times when battered women are the visiting parent. This particular policy assumes that the batter is the visiting parent. So that's just an opportunity for stating the exception. Ellen, those are my examples. You're next, I believe.
Okay.
Can I throw in just a little comment about stating exceptions? I think it gets really tricky to try to write every possible exception into a policy. So part of the challenge is, can we write and articulate our policy within, kind of connecting back to within our mission and our principles in such a way that provides an anchor and we allow for a certain amount of discretion in meeting that. Now, that's not very precise, but I just kind of the main thing that popped into my head there was this. And when you start writing to specific exceptions, that kind of gets tricky.
And Jane, the other thing that I think is helpful when you start exploring what the exceptions are out loud before you put this policy in place is that it also challenges you to really think through, is this actually the policy that we want in place, or do we have too many exceptions? Because I think sometimes when you're writing a policy, you make an assumption of how this is going to be, and you write it to that. And then you have a lot of, well, what if, what if, what if. And if you have a lot of those, you may want to challenge how you framed the policy in the first place and why you have it that way.
And if you have that clearly articulated reason that you have the policy, you have something to check all of those exceptions against.
You know, I think that I want to add to what you're just saying there, Mo, about when you articulate a reason that you have the policy, it should be in kind of just plain old language. And what's missing in all these policies, I think, is the plain old language that visitation centers generally are trying to limit the contact between the adults. They're trying to set up a design for this visitation center where the two adults will not have any contact with each other, because that is a main way they're going to try to do safety, is make sure that there's no contact between the two. And particularly, they're trying to make sure that the person, if they know who has been the aggressor in the relationship, does not have the opportunity to use coming to the visitation center as a method of harassment, verbal or physical abuse. Now, these don't say that in there, but that's exactly what the intent of the policy is. It goes right from this vague statement of, we want to make safety, so we're going to have two different entrances. You know, why are we having two different entrances? If you make it clear, we're trying to make sure that these adults do not see each other or have any contact. And we're particularly trying to make sure that if someone's been battering someone else, that they don't have an opportunity to get to that person because she or he is having to come to the center every week. So that, by making that kind of invisible, these policies become vague to people who aren't in the everyday kind of language of visitation centers. All of us listening on the phone know this. It's real clear to us. You're trying to keep him and her away from each other, but it's not ever in these policies. So I think that the other thing is, what's the plain old language that you would say to someone? Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? And once you can answer that plain old language, that should be what's in your policy. Would you agree with that, Mo?
I would agree with that. And I think if you, it's not just important that we can use our articulated statements when we write the policies to make sure that we are, I mean, that we are creating the policies that we want, but we want them to be apparent to the people who are using these services.
Yeah. And so that comes to the same thing about, for example, children refusing to visit. Children refuse to visit for a lot of reasons. And the policy here is not the problem so much if you look at sample one or even sample two, but it's the articulation of what is it that you're trying to accomplish. And I think what policy one is trying to accomplish is, before they cancel a visit, a child showed up at the scene, before they just say, okay, you don't want to visit, fine, we'll do it, they want to make sure that that really is what the child wants, or they want to make sure that if the child, you know, they want to make sure that the child does have the opportunity to visit if that is, you know, something that the child is kind of oriented towards. But the child, for some reason, might just be afraid right at the second, like, oh, I don't know, da-da-da-da. And so it's really trying to help the child make that visit possible if that's what the child wants. That, again, is not articulated in here. What is the purpose of these? If you look at lines 22 through 26, if age appropriate, take the child aside and speak with him or her in private. It asks if they want a short visit. What's the purpose of all of this intervention when children don't want to visit? I think the purpose from this visitation center is to make the visit happen if, in fact, the child just needs a little support to make it happen, as opposed to pressuring the child into doing it. And yet that isn't really articulated here as the intent of the center. So you'll see that. Go through. I'll tell you a funny little story. We had a round table, and we had all these visitation centers of people who really had been around a long time. The guy who's the director now of SDN, Joe Nullet, and Tracy Parker from right outside of Kent, people who have been doing visitation center work forever, and they all were, you know, they go out and help other people set up visitation centers. And we said, okay, bring all your policies in so we can review them together and critique them. And everybody got their policies out, and then all of a sudden they didn't want to bring them to the meeting, and they didn't want to pass them out because they could find all these things. So when we get done with this whole thing, when you read your policies, you go, oh, my gosh, this isn't right and this isn't right. And that's kind of the purpose of this whole thing. But at the same time, you want to play like you have to bring this policy to this phone call, and that we're going to critique it in front of 56 people listening right now, or 83 or however many are listening. And then you'll start asking these questions yourself. Are we making it clear what we're trying to say? Is it client-centered, which is our next thing? How do you make your policy client-centered? And so I just want to read you, go to sample one, alcohol and drug policy. Many of the people who use your visitation centers are alcoholic and drug addicted. That's why they are at your – that's a major reason they're at your center. They're at your center because of violence, and they're at your center oftentimes because of drug and alcohol. These two things come together in a lot of people's lives in ways that are very destructive to their life, to what they want as a person, to their relationships with their children. So drug and alcohol abuse has been a major disruptive piece of many people's lives, and they come to your centers, addicted people, people who are suffering because of this addiction that they have. Now read sample one. Alcohol and drugs are not permitted at the center. Any clients, staff, or volunteers under the influence of alcohol or drugs may be asked to leave the facility. I don't know which ones aren't going to be asked, but if a client is under the influence of drugs or alcohol, the staff will decide if further services will be terminated. Local law enforcement may also be notified. This is the only language in this policy about alcohol and drugs. Now, if I'm an alcoholic or a drug-addicted person using this center and I read this, It says, you show up here on drugs and alcohol, and we'll decide if we're going to give you further services. Local law enforcement may be notified. It's not very client-friendly or alcoholic-friendly. And that's not to say that you have to say to alcoholics, look, we know you've got a problem. If you come on in drunk, and we'll see if we can handle you. I'm not suggesting that. But what I am suggesting is this is almost punitive, not punitive, but it's real authoritarian in language, not very what I would call client-friendly and not very drug-addicted client-friendly. Think of a mother of four kids who's lost custody of her children to a batterer because she's an alcoholic. She obviously is suffering a lot because of all those losses, and she's not able at this point in her life to stop drinking. What should that policy, how should it be written to her? Because you're writing this to the alcoholic, to the drug-addicted person. So think of that. What's a way of saying this that's going to get the staff to have both compassion for her but clarity on however you're coming down on this issue of drug and alcohol at the center? The next one, I just want to say a similar thing. We believe that being under the influence of drugs and alcohol causes everyone's safety to be at risk. That's an underlying assumption of this policy, but if you look at it from the client's perspective, it's not true that people who are under the influence of drug and alcohol are dangerous always to their kids. It's true that alcohol and drug use there's a high correlation between violence and alcohol and drug use. It's true that visitation centers don't really know which alcoholic and drug-dependent people, when they're using, or even non-dependent people when they're using, become dangerous. Now, that might be true. We can't tell who's dangerous and who isn't, and so we have this general rule saying no drugs or alcohol. But it's not true that just the use of drugs or alcohol makes someone dangerous to children, because there's many, many, many alcoholics out there that are raising their kids every day and have never abused them. So we have to challenge ourselves about some of these statements to make them come from a position of, oh, you apply this to people's lives. Is it always true? Is it sometimes true? But what is true is that visitation centers don't want to be in a position of having to decide, is this a safe use of alcohol or not, because you'll get it wrong. And so what you're saying is, because of the high correlation, we are just saying no alcohol or drugs on site. So that's a different way of saying it, and it also speaks then to a broader experience instead of saying to every alcoholic person, you are dangerous to everyone's safety, which isn't really very true. In fact, it's a major reason that some women are losing custody of their kids to batterers, by saying, look, she can't be trusted. She's an alcoholic. Trust me, the batterer. I'll take custody of the kids. So I think it's important that we get in the shoes of people who are reading these rules or policies about themselves, and that's one method of being client-centered. The other one is to try to figure out who does this exclude. So I want to go back to the alcohol and drug policy one. And I want to apologize. Somebody's on the line last week who said they really wanted to, you know, they don't agree with this thing that I'm going to say now about people who are chronic alcoholics using visitation centers. And it's a big debate and discussion, so I don't want to just cut that off by what I'm going to say. But this is a legitimate debate that we can all have. But you have some people who are using your center who get up every morning, and if they don't have a drink, they're going to start shaking and they're going to go into withdrawal. So people get up and take whatever it is that they get to calm their bodies down. They're addicted to alcohol or drugs in ways that they can't make it through a 24-hour period without going into withdrawal. So what are you going to do with those people at your visitation center? Is it imaginable that you would say, if we have a policy that really says this, that if you come in under drug and alcohol, that we're going to terminate your visit, and maybe even terminate your ability to visit, then are we then excluding certain people from using our centers? Can a visitation center say to this parent, you're a chronic alcoholic, you drink every day, here's going to be the rules for when you come in here. You can't come in here drunk, and what's the word for it when you're you're not really in control of yourself because of the alcohol or drugs. That doesn't mean that if you've had a drink that morning that you can't come and visit your kid at 2 o'clock. So how would you work that out with a person who has a chronic alcohol problem? Would you feel that doing that and arranging that with the other parent is actually allowing access that is part of what visitation centers are trying to do? They're allowing access to a parent who, for one reason or another, cannot live with that child. So I'm just going to stop with that now and say that being client-centered means, are we going to make this absolute rule, or are we going to look to say, why would somebody not fit this rule, and how could we make an exception for that? So let's go on to Jane with this notion of defining the policy components.
And that element is asking us to kind of step back and really think about and be clear about saying, what are we going to do, who's going to do it, defining operative words and phrases. We often, well, safety is that big word that we use and we put out there, and to step back and say, well, what do we mean by that exactly? Do we mean a very limited safety in a physical bodily sense? Do we mean safety in a broader kind of ongoing well-being kind of sense? What is our mission and our role, and how are we defining safety in the work that we do? It's looking at time frames. It's looking at state laws that might or come into play. Thinking about the degree and nature of supervision. Are there certain areas of discretion that are pretty open? Are there other areas that really require a supervisor to be involved in the discussion? So, for example, perhaps part of shaping this policy around alcohol and drug use might be to look at where is the level of supervisory review. So if someone comes for a visitor or exchange, perhaps an exchange, and the visitation staff is concerned about, is this a safe situation to send these children with this person who's going to be driving in this car? Perhaps that's a setting under which there needs to be some real clear supervisory consultation and oversight as well. So it's kind of figuring out how that aspect of supervision fits into everything. It's looking at the responsibilities of those participating in the program, articulating what's expected of parents coming to the center, how you're expecting them to meet those requirements or conditions. It's looking at, again, and I think the theme that's kind of coming up here in our conversation this afternoon is, when and how can you adapt things to individual circumstances? How do we make it client-centered in the first place? And then how do we adapt it and provide some leeway to address those situations where, if our goal is to support safety for adult and child victims of battering and other forms of domestic violence, how does this policy work in relation to that, and when and where do we need some adaptation to individual circumstances? So when we read through, for instance, the samples we've got here, they pretty much lump everyone together into either a custodial or non-custodial parent. And there's not a lot of articulation. Actually, I'm not sure there's really any articulation of how this might work differently if the visiting parent is the parent at risk, is a mother who's being battered, who has lost custody and is now at the visitation center. So this kind of overall design of how have we put this together, how does it fit our mission and purpose, making sure that we're really articulating each piece of our policy and thinking about it. One of the things that I found when I was looking at the samples and thinking about applying this, defining the policy components, is I started writing down a lot of questions. And, for example, under this the first sample of child refusal policies, I started looking at, well, this is a bit of a jumble. You know, it starts out with this statement, if a child or parent refuses to come to the center will notify the court and referring agency. Well, is that the policy? You know, that kind of first sentence, is that the heart of the policy? Or is the heart of the policy down at the very bottom where it says on line 27, at no time will staff ever make or pressure a child to visit with non-custodial parent when the child refuses? So kind of stepping back and really looking at what are we meaning here, what's going to be done and who will do it. I think with this example, you could kind of step back and apply the first elements of our architecture and see that it needs some work, both in how it's phrased, how the intent is articulated, to what extent and how it's client-centered, and then the specific components in it. So again, emphasizing that we're not necessarily looking at these elements separate and distinct from one another or in a really sharp linear sequence, but fitting together as this fabric of designing policy.
You know, Jane, can I throw in something here about, this is a really good example about the children visiting. And let's say you were working at a visitation center and you were kind of struggling with what it is that, and then if you were to try to explain to me, well, what are you trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that I think that's when it's really helpful. Like, what is it that you're trying to do by having a policy around children who don't want to visit? And what is your goal here? What is your intent? So can you just answer that question to me for a second? You're a visitation center person.
Well, my intent would be not to cause more harm or upset to kids.
Mm-hmm. Okay, keep talking. You're trying to not do anything that's harmful to them?
Right.
Are you trying to help them make this visit, or what?
Well, that's where it gets a little more complicated, because, I pretty much want it to go smoothly, because I know that this is going to cause some trouble, perhaps, for their mother, who's having to bring kids to the center. She's trying to deal with all of their feelings about everything that's happened and kind of all of the fallout that goes into that decision to separate, to leave, to try to make a different life that's safer for herself and her kids. And
so let me just say, if I were to keep asking you questions to the point where you're starting to say, well, really what I want to do is, if it's possible for the kids to make that visit without being harmful to them, I'd like that to happen. Or I'd like it to be that the kids who are ambivalent, they have a chance to work through that ambivalence. The kids who aren't ambivalent, they're not being pressured. Things like that. Once you can start to articulate, that's what we're trying to do, that's what you can see that these policies haven't done enough amongst themselves to write the policy, because they've got these clear ideas in here of, okay, we're going to take the child aside and speak to them. We're going to say, okay, what about a shortened visit? So they're obviously trying to make the visit happen, but it's not being articulated as to what is it you're trying to do. And then for that child and for, like you're bringing in what's going to be helpful for that, the adult victim using this center. The child saying, I don't want to visit, can actually work against the adult victim.
So right, and I'm thinking if I have some really surly teenagers who are
all that's going to do is
making
cause
life
more
miserable.
Trouble. Yeah. So I think that's the kind of down-home conversations that you should have in your centers. When, as soon as you start to write a policy, say, what are we trying to do here? And then when somebody says something like, trying to keep everybody safe, what's the assumption about what's making them not safe? Keep pushing each other. Be like us, like we're sitting there questioning you. Be, you know, and then question each other about this until you can really get a much clearer articulation of what you're trying to do. And then
do you,
ask, is it centered on people? Yeah.
Well, and for example, do you really want to notify the court or referring agency about every refusal to participate?
Yeah, and there's a
you
lot
really
of fixing.
You really want to do that.
In these samples, there's a lot of mixing up of what Mo talked about last week, the difference between policy and procedure. Like, let me just say, a policy would be that the visitation center is going to make every attempt to have no contact between the two adults. And that's the policy, and they're going to design their center to do that. The procedures are this double door thing, this, you know, somebody checks in first. Those are procedures. Those aren't policies. And it's that the policy is this thing you're trying to do, and the board of directors is saying to you, staff, don't let these two people have contact with each other. Design the center that way. That becomes your policy. Then all these ways that you've set up to do it becomes your procedures. And so you see a lot of mixing of procedure and policy in all of these samples. The same thing about your overall policy, what, is to not pressure children into having visits they don't want, but accommodating and trying to facilitate visits for children with some ambivalence. Something like that is your policy.
Right.
Procedures are these things that are written here.
Right. And
I'm going to do a little time check for you all. So we want to take questions in about 5 to 10 minutes. So if, we can keep that in mind of the other three things that you wanted to move through before we take questions.
Actually, I'll move us along, but not really get off this point, because I actually wanted to talk a bit about this first sample of the child refusal policy for a handful of reasons. And actually, I think the things that Ellen and Jane were talking about really are the key things. Is once it's clear that it would be very hard to draw up the larger imperative for this policy just by reading it. But once that conversation happens, then the accountability element is easier. Then it's clear what the purpose of the policy is. So whenever there are policies specifically for the Safe Haven Supervised Visitation Program, and I would say more broadly, when you're dealing with the whole issue of domestic violence, there are a series of sort of accountability questions that you want to ask yourself, and that is this policy accountable to adult and child victims of abuse? Is this policy accountable to the center's own standards and principle? And not just the policy, but the policy and the procedure, I'm sorry. Is it accountable to the other organizations and other practitioners? Is it fair and respectful to parents who have battered? And is it also dealing with the whole issue of accountability of the action of the batterer toward the people who have been harmed? So if you had a clear articulation of what it is you were trying to do around having a child refusal policy, you could literally go through and say, what is our overriding reason for doing this? And then how does that address the safety issues for victims of abuse? How does it deal with our own standards and principles? And then I think the one that has to do with other organizations and practitioners is where things get a little muddy. Because people will say, well, there's a court order. So if there's a court order, then it must happen, and I have a role in carrying out that court order. Well, you know, unless you're a visitation center that's directly tied to a court and you are actually part of that order, that's a different question, and it's worthy of a conversation. And so that's why no matter what it is that you do, the most clear articulation of the policy and the procedure, it has to come first. So you know what the role of your visitation center, the role of your service is as you go through this accountability sort of matrix, I guess. Did you all want to jump in on that?
Yeah, no, I'm just agreeing with what you're saying.
I don't see you shaking your head, Ellen. So that's sort of the whole thing about ensuring that there's an evaluative process to make sure that you are actually doing what it is that you say that you want to do, which means you got to say it clearly first.
You know, Mo, one thing I would add, just, and, you know, you're from the Council on Juvenile and Family Court Judges, so you should be thinking more like a lawyer than me, but one thing I would say, just for your own safety as a visitation center, when you make a policy and someone doesn't follow it and someone gets hurt, you're suable, much more suable than if it's not a policy. And so when you say something like in the policy here, which I actually think is a procedure, it's the... By the way, all these things we're saying about procedures, the rules about procedure making are very similar. It's not like we're saying, here, this is only about, this is about policy and procedure making as a unit. But when you look at this last page, it says here that the sheriff's deputy will scan a parent with a metal detector wand. Now, that's a policy of that center. Let's say 5 minutes
before... That's a procedure of that center, right?
No, this is part of their policy.
Oh, got it, got it.
So let's say 5 minutes before the center opens, the deputy says, oh, I can't make it tonight, I'm sick, or, you know, I just got in an accident on the way there, and he doesn't show up. So the center is probably going to still function anyways. It's going to go on. It's not going to have the deputy there. Now, let's say that nobody gets wanded that night, and then that guy does something like simply he pulls out something out of his hand, and he hits someone or anything like that. Because you didn't wand him that night, and it's part of your policy, you are now susceptible to a lawsuit in a different way than it wasn't your policy.
That's true.
So I think it's important for you to recognize that when you say you're going to do these things, if you're not going to do them every time, no matter what, don't put them in as a policy, because you make yourself vulnerable to things. What you can say as a policy is that you will work with the sheriff's department to have security available for those families where it's been deemed necessary. That way, if something happens, you didn't deem necessary that that family have a security thing, but you would have particular people that you say, you're never going to arrange a visit with this person unless there's a security guard there. So you want to just think in terms of when is always really always, or you're making yourself vulnerable. So I put that in under accountability, Mo, because...
No, I'm glad you did, Ellen, yeah. Because it really wasn't out of point that I was going to bring up, but it is critically important, and anybody... who operates any sort of program is very well aware of that. So I think, you know, absent even bringing that up is sort of naive. But
okay.
That was what I was going to say.
Okay, okay. So then the this isn't the last.
No, we got
I'm going to make one more, Jane. Double-check your design. So if you look at the notes here, you've got your policy written, and you're going back and you're saying, does this really fit our mission and our purpose? So if our mission and our purpose is what? It depends on what your mission and purpose is, and we talked about this last time, that OVW is in some ways challenging visitation centers to have a more engaged role with families than they have in the past. They've expanded by the six principles the function of visitation centers, and in doing so, they've kind of broadened the mission of visitation centers. So if your mission is to really help some of these people through this two-year period or this period of transition to help them get through that without doing more harm, then your policies should reflect a less oftentimes authoritarian, if you don't do this, you're out, and more a thing of this is how we're going to try to accomplish that mission. So you would find that those visitation center policies that actually look like the old rules of visitation centers, you've got to do this and this and this and this or you're out, probably don't fit your mission anymore. If your mission is going to expand to protect adult victims with equal regard to the whole notion of respect, of multiculturalism, all those kind of things, if you build that into your mission, you don't want such a kind of rule-oriented policy anymore. So ask that question, and then, again, really try to separate this thing out of what is it the board is saying. Staff, I want you to do this. And what the board is basically saying is, staff, we don't want the adults to have contact with each other, to have access to hurting each other. We want a center where we can keep these two apart. That's what the board says. It's up to you, staff, through administrative procedures to figure out how you're going to do that. So check your policy again for that. check to see what the underlying assumptions are. If you make a statement saying the use of alcohol and drugs is a safety issue, yes, it is, but don't make a statement that says alcohol and drugs are unsafe. They in and of themselves are not. In certain bodies, they're unsafe. So you want to keep challenging these assumptions that you're making, these universal statements. That's not to say that you don't get to make rules about alcohol and drug use, and that's not to say that there's not a correlation between danger and alcohol and drug, but you want to keep pushing yourself to be precise and to make your assumptions transparent and then to let people challenge you and say, I don't even think that's true. I think you're making this statement, but it's not necessarily true. So blah, blah, blah. You want to really have a lot of feisty discussions about your underlying assumptions. And then you're limited in your resources, so you may want to do X, but you can only do Y, and I think you can say that, you would like to be able to do a full assessment of everyone coming in there and then offer this and this and this, but you can't. So because you can't, you're erring on the side of safety, and you're really asking every family to adhere to this policy. So you are unable to do the kind of specific work with every single family. Everyone in the whole system is. The courts can't do it. You can't do it. Mental health workers can't do it. We can't, absolutely address every particular need of every family. And so we're oftentimes, because of limited resources, forced to do a more general practice, but we should be able to articulate when we're doing that. And then finally, your policies need to be, you have to think of, when you look at some of the policies here, they go back and forth to be written to the client, and then next they're written to the staff person. And policies are statements of the board. This is who we are, what we are. This is what we will do. This is what we expect of you, the client. If you're making a policy to staff, you don't necessarily talk to them the way some of these policies do. Let me give you an example, page 30, line 35. Remember, we're here to make this a positive experience for the child. We want them to have fun and feel safe while they're waiting for the visiting parent. You may also have to help the child if they're having trouble separating from the parent. That's not policy language to a staff person. That's kind of almost a training language. So you want to think, who are we talking to and what language are we doing that? Sometimes it's the board saying, here, this is what we are committed to giving you. Sometimes it's to the staff saying, the staff will. And sometimes it's to the client saying, the expectation of the client is. So you're kind of dividing out who that audience is. And that's your kind of check as you go through at the end. And finally, you always want to check to see, did you build into your policy the proper compliance and accountability issues? And part of that is that the policy should say that the staff will have the training to do X, Y, and Z. Then if the staff aren't properly trained and they don't do a good thing, then it's the client gets to say, look, you were supposed to have your staff trained to do this kind of stuff, and they weren't, and they weren't able to do their job. And that's a fair expectation that clients should have of your center, that the staff are properly trained. Okay, Jane, you're on the last tip.
But Jane, okay, before you go, we're going to ask questions as soon as Jane gives a couple of points on this last element. So push number one now, because there is a bit of a delay, so you may be cut off of questions if you don't. Get ready. All right, Jane.
Okay. Well, our last design element is to provide implementation guidelines. And part of that, and we mentioned this a bit, and we'll kind of wrap up with this piece about communicating the policy to everyone involved, that there are different audiences for the policy, and how that's communicated is an important piece of the overall architecture of the policy. A second point is to establish operating procedures. And again, we've kind of talked about this jumble of what's a policy, what's a procedure. Generally, that policy is something that isn't readily changed. You think of the way a board comes together to develop policy. It's not something that's going to change from one month to the next. It requires a certain level of attention and work, and it lays out the what, if you will, what must be done. The procedures are how you're going to go about doing that. And that becomes more of an administrative function that has some leeway to change, to adapt to different circumstances. So along with the policy articulating this is what we expect and this is how our agency will operate and this is what must be done, come that set of how we're going to do it, the forms, the instructions, the documentation, the training to make it real. Another element in that is to provide workers with examples of the policy in action. So as you're putting this all together, how do you really see this working? I think training is really intertwined with policy, particularly if it's something new, it's the first time, it's a new area of attention, brand new visitation center, no one's done this before, or a brand new policy area, there has to be a way for the workers who are expected to implement it to get familiar with it, to see it in action, to practice, to maybe use different simulations or scenarios to get a feel for it. And you wouldn't necessarily do this with every single policy, but kind of take a look at where do we want to really build this kind of familiarity and practice. Something, for example, like around children who are reluctant to visit. It's a policy area. It's a big one that's a real sticky point for a lot of folks in visitation centers. And the policy is going to have more meaning if it's implemented with some element of training and practice along with it. And providing these implementation guidelines doesn't mean clunking down a policy in front of, and this is one of Jane's pet peeves, setting it down in front of a worker and saying, here, sign on the bottom line saying, I have read and agreed to follow all of these policies. That's not really providing examples of policy in action and making it real. It's a covering your butt kind of approach, but not really carrying policy into practice in a real kind of way. So I think we're overdue for questions, aren't we, Beth?
We are. So, Stephanie, do we have any people in the question queue? If you have a question, push 1. Anybody been waiting patiently?
Yes, we do have a caller. Diana, your line is open.
Yeah, hi. Wouldn't it make more sense to, for instance, like with the alcohol and drug policy in quotation marks, to just put it down as a guideline? Because, again, I don't know if there is any way to write something like that to account for, you know, everybody's need. But if it's a guideline, then it's easier to write, and then people can use it their own, you know, their own expertise and judgment. Doesn't that, you know, and I don't mean judgment over people, you know what I'm saying, over the situation, doesn't that make more sense? Why does everything have to be a policy?
Oh, I was talking away and I found myself, I was on mute. But, yeah, I think you're right that you, one of the things you want to say is, does this require a policy? Does this require a procedure? Or does this require a guideline? And all, sometimes it requires all three, and sometimes it only requires guidelines with procedures. I think if the basically you think about in terms of, does your board of directors or the people who have control of your organization, do they want to design a policy that says, as an organization, this is what we'll do? If they don't, if the thing is too minutia to do that, then they can put that aside and have it be a procedure or a guideline. But generally speaking, you want your authoritative group to say, we're going to give direction so that this kind of carries out this way. And I would say that most visitation centers will want to have a drug and alcohol policy. If nothing else, they'll have one on their staff that staff cannot use it, but they'll probably want to have something like a drug and alcohol policy. But and some may, like you're saying, Diana, say, well, no, we're going to go more with a guideline on this and not a policy. But that's really up to the individual organization as to what kinds of issues do they want to be directive about as a board.
Okay. Thank you.
Stephanie, do we have any more questions?
At this time, there are no additional questions.
All right. Well, don't be shy. We're going to carry on, but that doesn't mean you can't push number one, and we'll gather up your questions, hopefully before the end of the call. Okay. So, Mo, you're going to take us away on our final push here, and we're going to talk about adapting our policies to different readers and different audiences.
Okay, and I think both Ellen and Jane have spoken a bit to this issue sort of throughout the last hour, so I don't want to really kind of belabor the point too much, but as Ellen stated, that we're going to be really needing to address a variety of different audiences. So the board, as the policy-making body, it as an audience of the Visitation Center sort of organization, the policies coming from the board are much more formal and they're overarching. And I can't really state this enough. And more than 20 years in working with nonprofits, I think the importance of stopping and drafting out the accompanying rationale and the explanations for these policies is critically important. I think that more than anything else will help you figure out what is a policy, what is a procedure, what's a guideline, what's really about training. So if I leave you with no other thoughts, I leave you with the importance of going through this process as your board of directors is doing its policymaking work. And doing it in such a way that is directly informed by the experiences of the people who are actually using the services of the center and the people who are providing the services of the center. And in so doing, in the crafting of these overarching policies, and in ensuring that the accompanying rationales are there, it builds sort of a long-term institutional memory as to why this is the direction this organization has gone. You may have an executive director that's been there for 20 years, but you probably will not have a board member who's been part of this for all of those 20 years. So that also provides real solid guidance to your board of directors as to what the intent of the service that you're providing is, how they can step in and be a resource, because as many of you know, some of the folks on your board of directors are never going to have provided a visitation service. They may have never even entered into a courthouse, but they are interested in the service that you're providing. So this is actually a training tool for them and understanding sort of the long-term goals of the work that you do. So that's just a couple of my parting tips for working with board members and the role of the board in developing policy for your visitation center.
Okay, and I will address our second important audience, which are the Visitation Center's clients, and that is the women, the men, the children using the center need to understand what all the particular policies are that are relevant to their participation. And again, I think here too, you have to really think about structuring this in a way that's not plunking down 10 sheets of paper and saying, here, sign this, and we agree to do this, but building meaningful ways to explain what the purpose is, what the mission, what the expectations are, and accounting for how people understand that, literacy level, first languages, the way in multiple ways of conveying the meaning of the policies and the expectations to those who are using the center, and also providing an avenue to say, and here's what you can do when you feel that this policy is not being followed, when this program or this action or something has happened that is not in sync with what we have said we will do and how we will do it. So bringing all of those things together. Part of my background is in policing, and I'm always really intrigued to see when police agencies post all of their policies on the website, because I think that's an example of providing your policy in a very big way to your clients, namely the members, people who live in your community. And there's a certain level of accountability in putting it out there in that way, where you can readily discover what's the expectation, what's the promise, if you will, of this organization to me as a resident of the community. So be thinking about how do you convey the promise of your visitation center to the people who are using it.
Okay, and I'm in charge of talking a little bit about writing your policy for workers, and I want to tell people about what my favorite little policy is. It's the St. Louis County Sheriff's Office Domestic Violence Handbook and Training Guide for Patrol Deputies, and it's on the Praxis website. It's the St. Louis County Sheriff's Office Handbook and Training Guide for Deputies. And when you open up this little booklet, it's exactly how you should write a policy to your workers, to people at the center, because in gray boxes is the whole policy going through this whole booklet, and it'll give a policy like here's one of the policies. Deputies responding to domestic assault-related calls will conduct a thorough initial investigation. In accordance with state law and office policies, deputy will complete a report whenever they respond to any domestic assault call, regardless of whether they identified probable cause. Officers will utilize either the short or the long-form domestic violence report in writing these reports. And then it goes on for 4 pages to show the short report format and why it's there, the long report format and why everything is on it. And then it gives a sample good long report and a sample good short report. And then it goes on to the next thing in the policy. So this is a really nice handbook, and it takes them through every policy regarding responding to a call, and then it tells them why they're doing it, and then it shows them how to do it, all the protocols, and then it actually gives samples and suggested ways of doing it. This little handbook, I think if you got a hold of that, you can download it off the Praxis website. You could just follow a format like this to do your handbook for employees, and it's a very nice, nifty, neat little thing, and OVW will love you.
So, oh, and I will send it out to everyone who registered for the call.
Oh, okay. It's a nice distinction, too, between policy and procedure, I think.
And can I just say, Ellen and Jane, if you don't mind my jumping in, if you will look at lines 69 through 91, you're going to see a mix of audiences that this particular policy, which is very procedural, is trying to address. I think it's a very good example of when you're speaking to a worker, when you're speaking to a parent, when you're speaking to somebody else. So I think it's a really good example of an opportunity for tailoring the language based on the different audiences.
And then, Mo, if I can just say, as long as people are looking at 69 to 91, line 91, the very last line on your handout, if either parent is 15 minutes late, the visitation is canceled. Now, you know if somebody calls up and said, oh, my God, my car just slid off the road and I'm in the ditch, I'll be there in 22 minutes, you're not going to cancel the call. So you never write a policy that isn't as fact like that, that isn't really fact. But it is that the center reserves the right to cancel visits if a parent is 15 minutes late. That is a fact that you reserve that right to cancel it, and you will typically.
Yep.
But you're not going to cancel it every time. So just keep looking at all those things that you're saying and when you really mean it and when you don't. So any other questions that people have? Or would you press star one?
Just one. We can take a few final calls.
Oh, just
Stephanie.
One.
Just one. If you push it,
somebody out
one,
there has something to say. Even if you want to say something like, oh, come on, you guys, you didn't really mean to say this, did you?
Stephanie, do we have anybody who's willing to challenge that?
At this time, there are no guests in the queue.
They're afraid of you. I did get an email question, a couple of questions, actually, of the same question. When is this recording going to be available? Got that question in my email 3 times during this call. So I don't know if people just dozed off and wanted to catch up, or I don't know what that means exactly, but I'm going to take it as this was so good they want to listen to it again.
It's going to be on YouTube?
It will be on YouTube, that's correct. No, we will post it at the completion of the series, and usually by the time we gather that up, edit out kind of anything that needs to go. So you can anticipate that probably 3 weeks past next Tuesday for the final call, you can start looking for it. Sooner if possible.
Let me also just ask people to take the time to fill out the evaluation that Beth, they have it all now, don't they, Beth? Because it's very helpful to us. We read your ones from last time, and you can see we paced ourselves better. We actually listened to things you were saying. But it's really helpful to us to see how this is or isn't working for you. And next time is our last one on this topic. So anything we're not addressing or questions you had about this that you'd feel better asking in an email format. If you could do that and fill out that survey, it's really helpful to us.
Yes. So they will receive it after today's call in their email, and it takes 5 minutes, really, to fill that out, so we do encourage you to do that. So I'd like to take this last couple of minutes to say thank you to Mo and Ellen and Jane for taking the time to do this with us. I'd like to say thank you to all of you who took time out of your day to stop and think about policy development.
Excuse me, Beth?
Yes.
I do apologize. We do have two guests in the queue at this time.
Oh, very good. Okay, brave ones.
Okay. First, we do have Barbara. Your line is open.
This is Barb Stamper, and I'm calling. I've really enjoyed this training series so far. It's really been good, and it's really made me stop and think about the difference between policies and procedures. But I have some questions, and I'm not sure I'm asking it right, but I guess if your court has guidelines that they order into the order for the visitation, supervised visitation, or if you know that there is a history of denying access, the court knows that there's a history of denying access to a parent, and you're trying to do that, I guess I'm thinking about how do we take into consideration, do we make that policy incorporate the guidelines of the court? Well, in my case, I would have to because I'm local government funded mostly. But I guess that's what I'm thinking, because when I'm thinking about all of this thing, like I didn't like the ones about the child refusal policy.
But you would like to have something in your policy that when you say that your idea is to kind of give access whenever you can, but not to pressure a child.
Yes.
Now, that can be your policy. But then in your procedures, you can say the staff should consider if there's been a history of one parent refusing to let a child visit when determining to what extent to talk to the child about this. See what I mean?
Yes.
Then
okay.
You get to do that in a procedure that doesn't necessarily apply to everyone, but your policy is to try to facilitate access without pressuring a child.
Okay. So you could really address the denial of access in your procedures.
Yeah, because you're interested in those cases which are not necessarily, they're kind of maybe a small number of cases, but important ones where denying access has been a major issue in that family. And so that's one thing that staff should consider in making a determination about speaking with the children.
Right. And I bring this up because this is a difficult thing for, especially for us right now, because we're kind of seeing a trend of batters getting custody of their children.
Uh-huh.
And it's a concern because sometimes the victim doesn't always cooperate for a multitude of reasons, you know, out of fear or a lot of reasons why
right.
She doesn't always cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm trying to work and our advocate, but also in supervised visitation, too, trying to work with this person, trying to get them to understand the importance of not denying access. For that reason, because I see when that happens, sometimes the court turns around and says, oh, well, you know, then we'll just give the other person custody.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess that's why I don't want a policy that says exactly what I kind of want to leave it broad.
And that's exactly the kind of thinking you want to do,
exactly.
You know, so that then could you articulate to someone, this is what I want my policy to say, and then challenge it like that, and then you'll get this policy that says, we want to facilitate access whenever possible. We don't want to force children to visit a parent or put pressure on a child. And that probably you could do that and still be more interventionist on those places where you think the parent is actually causing the child to say, I don't want to go.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Stephanie,
okay.
Do we have one more question?
Yes, we do. Next, we do have Cecilia. Your line is open.
Hi. My name is Rosalind Petrie. I'm here with Cecilia. But we were here thinking and reading over the guiding principles, and in the section that talks about the role of the visitation center and along the lines of trying to create policy, it talks a lot about holding the batterer accountable. Could you give us some examples of what that should look like?
What, in, it says that in the guiding principles?
Yeah, page 7.
Yes.
Go, Mo.
Well, actually, a lot of, you know, the whole issue of holding batterers accountable for their violence and abuse during visitation and exchange, and sort of accounting for the battering that's already occurred, when we were working on the guiding principles, that got a lot of conversation because it was a part that really sort of needed to be vetted from the standpoint of, you know, how to provide visitation services. So among the things that actually, Beth, you, I may want you to jump in because you've done a lot more of this in practice, and a lot of the things that I would be talking about are more from a policy-making standpoint. Did I get your question right that you wanted to know more, what are some practice considerations around this, or what are some of the things that would be written into policies around this?
Kind of both. We were just kind of, you know, stumped by you know, how do we do that? Just some suggestions and ideas about,
Can I say one thing here, Mo, about it's the responsibility of the criminal justice system to hold batterers accountable for what they've done to victims. It's not the medical profession's responsibility or even, in a sense, visitation centers. It is your responsibility to hold them accountable as clients for stuff they're doing in your center. You know, as opposed to holding them accountable, you've battered her in the past, now we're going to hold you accountable to that.
Right.
What you're holding them accountable is to present acts of and continuation of that battering using you and your center. Would that be right, Mo?
Exactly.
So when he starts to do things like he will not, he's got custody of the kids, he will not bend one inch on anything when she wants to change a day of visiting because her work has changed. He says, no, the court said Tuesdays. The court means Tuesday. She'll have to go back to court. He's just, in a sense, harassing her through that. Holding him accountable is, look, you can make her go back to court, but it would be better if you worked this out with us because that, you know, you're being uncooperative and stuff like that. That's holding him accountable and not letting him, I mean, he might get away with it that she's going to have to go back to court, but you can try to work with him to say, why do you want to do this here? Why do you want to, why can't, she's working on that day, she can't make it that day, blah, blah, blah. So you're kind of not just letting them ride roughshod over her in that visitation center.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Aslan.
And dealing quickly, I think, with some of the compliance issues, being aware. I think the guiding principles, the larger document, does really kind of speak to some of the ways in which batterers will continue the abuse through a visitation and exchange, and really kind of speaks to ways that you can sort of look at things like compliance with an understanding of what battering is and an understanding of how batterers may be using the visitation center to sort of continue the abuse.
Yeah, you know, an example I can give is a case where a young girl had really long hair down to her waist, and he had he used the visitation center as an exchange place, and it was his first exchange off-site. He took the girl and had her hair cut really, really short and never talked to the mother about it. And it was a total messing with her, and the kid didn't want that. And so the visitation center did a good job of writing that up as a he's just saying, look, I'm the father, I have my rights too, but the visitation center wrote it up in a way that kind of held him accountable to that and saying, you know, this is not acceptable. If you're going to do a major thing like this on a visit, you should let us know and there should be a discussion. So some of these kind of things are times when you can see that he's messing with her and using the child to mess with her, to hurt her, to punish her or retaliate for leaving him or whatever. And you were actually there watching him use the child to do that. And so it was written up in a sense in that way.
Okay. So I want to thank everyone for hanging on the line with us for a few extra minutes here. To remind people that we will have the third part of our call next Tuesday at the same phone number at the same time, and materials will be emailed to you, and your evaluation will be emailed to you shortly. So thanks, everybody. Have a great day. Thank you to Mo, Jane, and Ellen again.
Thank you very much, Beth.
You're welcome.
For doing this all.
Thanks.
We'll catch you next week. Have a good day, everybody.
Bye-bye.